marijuana legalization also ushers in the return of the American hemp industry. Get the latest news from the author of Hemp Bound and Too High to Fail, Doug Fine, in our Hemp Day Hump Day update.
Well, time for us to dig into the industrial hemp once again, and our good friend Doug Fine is on the line ready to talk to us. How you doing, Doug?
Oh, couldn't complain. Lots of good New Mexico. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, although it's a little warm for my taste up here in Portland. We've had 25 days with over 90 degree temps, and I think today is going to be 26. It's a record here in Portland, but don't worry, there's no such thing as climate change. So, Doug, how are things going in the world of hemp? What can you tell us? What's the latest developments?
Well, season-wise in the U.S., it's sort of mid-season, and from sea to shining sea, hemp plants are growing. If folks follow me on Twitter at Organic Cowboy, I send a tweet out of these pictures people are sending me from all over the country of their hemp fields, which is a lot of fun. The flowers are starting in some parts of the country, so it's a really interesting thing to watch. One interesting thing to me politically, Russ, is I was speaking with a very prominent player in the Canadian hemp industry, very, very prominent, somebody that's been in it for a long time. And he was talking to me about progress in Canada, what kind of a season they're looking like they're having there. And then he mentioned that he thought that psychoactive cannabis legislation was moving really fast in both countries. If the Liberals win in Canada, their candidate fully endorses full legalization. And we talked a little bit about the state. And he said, but in the States, from what I understand, you know, the psychoactive cannabis farms, it's all indoors, right? And I thought that was a really interesting comment from somebody who was very prominent in one part of the hemp plant. And because really I sort of had to jump in and say, actually, there's a whole thing of outdoor cultivators and, you know, check out the book I wrote before Hemp Bound, Too High to Fail, with, you know, which really talks about how important sustainability is and when possible cultivating under God's sun. And this was all news to him that there even was this kind of industry, this kind of thing that I and others go around advocating all the time. So to me, it's kind of the education curve continues even for people within the industry.
Wow, that's remarkable that they wouldn't know that kind of stuff. But that's why we're here, is to keep getting the information out. So we've got people planting hemp all around the country. How many states right now have hemp in the ground? Do you know?
It's a good question. There's 24 states that are authorized that have some sort of cultivation, but they fall into generally two categories. One I'll roughly call the Kentucky model, the states that have figured out a way to do a deal so that there's smooth operation on seed import and federal permits so that people are completely legal on the federal and state level. Tennessee is an example of that. They had a kind of 11th hour agreement on for their farmers that were able to, as a result, get hundreds of acres in the ground and become a major hemp player. Right from year one, they're having a great year one. Kudos to Tennessee. The second category are states that have legislation and some kind of movement and momentum, some kind of program, but for one reason or another, either don't have that Kentucky level cooperation that makes it smooth at this interim level. For folks who are listening and aren't aware, we have this research provision that allows on the federal level that allows hemp. In hemp states that hemp cultivation, Section 7606 of the 2014 Farm Bill. Many states, including Kentucky, interpret that research to include sales and marketing. So it's a de facto full legalization in those states, but only certain of the states are really leaping on board. You have to have a state that's actively involved. Even if you are one of those 24 states that does have cultivation but doesn't have 100% state participation on board, some of those states are able to get a lot of acreage in, and that's the case of with a state like Oregon this year. And then there's a third category of a state like Hawaii that has only very, very limited one or two plots at a university. All of this exponentially growing per year.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So any measurement of you know, we know there's a lot of states, but how big are the crops? Still small research size, or are we getting to the point where we're finally going to be able to do something with this hemp?
The sizes vary. I'm about to go out and go do a second wave of research and journalism and covering this year's season. And so I'll have a better handle on acreage probably by our next Hempe Hump Day. But to give an example, well, 2 points I wanted to make on that, Russ. One is on a state like Oregon, where I've been watching fairly closely, it looks like Oregon's acreage is going to be significantly more than Kentucky's acreage was last year. Kentucky got a lot of press last year because their representatives for the state, their U.S. senators and others, really pursued and made sure that there was federal permits in place. And they only had 30-something acres planted last year. This year, up to 600 acres. And they're really, the brand of Kentucky is really boosted for that. But those are small acreage numbers. Oregon in its first year is going to have more than Kentucky had last year. So who knows last year if and when the state is able to get a more organized and direct system going next year, or maybe we'll have full legalization by next season, which would be really nice and not worry about all that stuff. But one other quick thing about research doesn't necessarily mean small plots. And that was part of the debate that was going on in Oregon this year. Kentucky does not limit the acreage that it grants for its permittees at all. There are some farms that are hundreds of acres long. Their agriculture secretary just tweeted the other day that he's visiting and discussing business plans on a 60-acre farm in Kentucky. So this notion that research means, oh, you're just doing like a half-acre little sort of test plot in some way, that's actually not what research is. And I make that point. That's not necessarily what research is. There's many different kinds of research. Certainly, if you want to do a seed study, there are certain weed studies you might do that might allow or mandate small acreage. But for me, I started researching hemp because I'm interested in a domestic non-fossil fuel solution for energy. And if you want to know whether or not hemp produces a large amount of biomass, you need to produce a large amount of biomass. So to do research into energy could require 100 or even thousands of acres farms.
All right. Well, we've got a question from our chat room, and this is interesting because I was just reading Dr. Bierman's new book, and he mentioned the whole quote about George Washington sowing the hemp plants rather too late, and all in the speculation as to whether it was hemp or he's trying to grow for psychoactive purposes. But this question is kind of related to that. Is a male hemp plant as valuable as a female hemp plant? Is there a difference just within the hemp plants themselves as to what you're wanting?
And it's an absolutely fantastic question. The answer is it can be. It depends on what you're growing it for. It's a really diverse crop with many applications, as people know. This model that I like to talk about so much, I wrote about in First Legal Harvest and Hempbound, called tri-cropping, allows a farming community to benefit from vertical integration of all facets of the plant. On the one hand, seed, flower, oil. And then on another hand, a fiber/herd, and then the third, energy or biomass or energy storage. And there could be some overlap amongst those three legs, tri-cropping. But to give you one example, China is really the leader in fiber, and especially hemp fiber for textiles. And because they grow large acreage, and explicitly because they tend to harvest and process by hand, and they want it that way, they have rejected opportunities to import large-scale processing, partly for employment reasons. But because they do that, they actually do get a different long or vast fiber quality in them between the males and the females, and they go to two different places for two different kinds of textiles. So there are applications, absolutely, for males and females on the hemp side, depending on what you're growing for. If you're growing for, like right now, there's a rush, a boom on the market for cannabinoids, especially CBD, coming from flowers, people saying, oh, they're growing hemp for that. It's under 0.3% THC. That would be a different story. That would be people growing more similar to the way psychoactive cannabis farm is growing and aiming for females. So it's different needs for different applications.
Hmm. All right. We're speaking with Doug Fine, the author of Too High to Fail and Hemp Bound. It's our Hemp Day Hump Day update. And remember, you can always email questions into me as well. I'm RadicalRuss@gmail.com. And our final question asks, you know, we've talked before about people being afraid of cross-pollination, hemp versus cannabis. But one of our listeners wants to know, has that ever actually been documented? Has that ever actually happened in the real world?
I'm not sure if it's ever happened. It's certainly, as far as I know from the literature and from speaking to other farmers, happened only very few times. In other words, statistically negligible times. Mm-hmm. Of the many studies that I've read on the subject, only one, a Canadian study, makes reference to, I don't remember if it was anecdotal, it wasn't really a part of the scientific study, but that the study mentioned that when there was a plant that was timed to flower at the same point, at the exact, you know, very, you know, with the hemp field growing, literally a psychoactive plant placed in the actual farm, that there may have been that case. But when I speak to farmers about it, as I say, in Europe, I've seen myself on field tours, different cultivars of hemp that are adjacent or very close to each other, and farmers, they're not concerned about it. If you use good agricultural techniques, for instance, of those espoused by the pioneering Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association, they have to worry about that kind of thing all the time. They've never had a failure or an incident like that amongst the crops that they deal with. It's really about good communication and good farming practices. But a lot of the pioneers that are moving into what today we're calling the hemp factor, I tend to think of it more of as one plant. I support all varieties of the plant passionately, especially when they're cultivated sustainably and outdoors. But the folks that are pioneers on the return of hemp in the States tend to also be, many of them, not all of them, certainly not in Kentucky and those kind of states, but here at least on the West Coast, west of the Mississippi, tend to also be psychoactive cannabis farmers or have a history of it. And when you speak to them without fail, what they say is the only time they see cross-pollination on their own psychoactive plants is pollen blown from other psychoactive plants onto their garden. And it's something they have to watch for. It's something that happens semi-regularly. They notice a few flowers, a few plants pollinated, and they take action to make sure that it doesn't damage their wider crop. For patients, in the case of pre-full legalization, patients are waiting. They need those crops to be successful. And so that's a message that I'm spreading. First of all, I don't think that the cross-pollination issue is one that we're going to be talking about a lot in coming years. I think it's something, as I say, what we as people who support the cannabis, return of cannabis to above ground economy, society, and agronomy are going to show the world that we can make it. Everybody work together and play nice.
All right. Well, that's good news, Doug. Thank you so much. And that's all the time we got, unfortunately. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Russ.
All right. When we come back, we'll have time for a radical rant. If you want marijuana unity, stop voting for my criminality.
You're tuned into the Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation. You're listening to Radical Russ on the Russ Belville Show.